Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting The Kingdom Choir, Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Welcome to Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. Great to be with you on this last Friday of summer, Paul, and you're still wearing shorts.
I'm still wearing shorts and risking frostbite. Now tonight, it's Roland's story, homecoming. I'm going to the football game, and of course you have the court, the ladies in the court wearing their prom dresses. I always feel underdressed, you know, like I was invited to tea at Downton Abbey and I'm wearing jeans or something.
Well, Paul, you're never underdressed here, although I am wearing longer pants today because, gosh, the temperature is going to be, what, in the 80s today? So for, you know, a California guy who likes warmth. But we're going to cool down this weekend, and apparently after this weekend, we're in the 70s and fall is really here. It officially starts in a couple of days.
I love fall. I like when the leaves turn and, well, winter kind of grows on you. Now, Dennis, you're in California. You've got it knocked, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, we have some cold weather out there. It might even get down to freezing out there a couple of times. You know, I understand it still gets chilly here in the winter.
Well, never say that to an Iowa.
No, I know that. We have a really good show on the way today, Paul. As I always say, Ed Sullivan would have said it that way, including a visit from our favorite history guy, Alex Fafer of the Ames History Museum, and he has some more stories about the old days in Ames when, as you know, Paul, the sale of liquor was a no-no.
I remember that. Then later, our friend and colleague Maggie Westfold celebrates her return from vacation. She'll join us with another of her unique takes on life in Iowa.
But first, our guest today, Andrew Allen. He is the president and chief executive officer of YSS, known all around these parts as Youth and Shelter Services, an agency that, as we know, does so much for children, teens, young adults, young mothers, you name it. YSS does it. Welcome to Local Talk, Andrew.
Yeah, really grateful to be here. Thanks so much, guys.
It is a pleasure.
Welcome, Andrew. Now, George Belitsos was the founder of YSS, and you're the one who succeeded him. You know, someone had to become president after George Washington left. And that's your job, isn't it? Following the founder.
That's right. Not an easy job by any stretch, but George laid a great foundation.
You became head of YSS 4 years ago, walking away, leaving a career at Principal Financial in Des Moines. You'd been there for 14 years. What prompted you to make such a drastic, some would call it a drastic career change, to come here and head up YSS?
Yeah, I probably answered that question 200 times in the few months after I made the decision. I had sometimes what I described as probably the greatest professional position in the state, if you liked community. Essentially, I represented a Fortune 500 company headquartered in Des Moines. We gave away $15 million a year to organizations like YSS, and that was my job. So I gave that up to, in turn, raise about $20 million a year to serve the kids across the state. I would say I really feel like I was moved on a couple of fronts. I'd been successful professionally. I had started in technology. I'd moved into community relations and become director of our corporate social responsibility. My boss had retired, and she was the president of the Principal Financial Group Foundation. I had set a five-year goal to succeed her and become president. And 6 months later, 4.5 years ahead of schedule, I got called into my new boss's office, and they said, we're just came out of a board meeting, and we're naming you president of the 24th largest corporate foundation in America. Mm-hmm. And I should have been ecstatic, and instead, I felt empty. I felt like maybe I was pursuing something that was more about self and more about a title than it was about achievement or impact. And about that time, over the course of the next year, I just felt like I was being called to something different. George had announced that he was going to retire. I had been connected with YSS since I was a kid when I was served. I was on the board. I led some fundraising campaigns. I would actually signed up to be on the committee to help select his successor. And enough people came forward and said, hey, why aren't you applying? That I threw my hat in the ring, and every step along the way, it was simply affirmed. And so today, to be in a position to get to work for and lead the organization that I essentially credit with saving my life is pretty cool. I'm grateful every day.
So you're called in by the president. You get this great news. It looks like a career topper. and you still felt a need to do something else. That's remarkable. But I think it probably comes from your life experience. You might tell us a little bit about your life experience when you first had contact with YSS as a young man.
Yeah, you bet. To have a 14-year career at principal and to have the opportunities that I had, you sure wouldn't have guessed that going back to my childhood. I was a Story County boy, grew up in small-town Iowa. There was only so much trouble you could probably get in the eastern part of the county in Nevada. But if it existed, I found it. I was arrested for felony charges on my 10th birthday that, had I been an adult, could have put me in prison for quite a while. I had parents that, you know, taught me right from wrong, going to church. I was, excelled in sports and school and actually got an award for having the highest grade point in my class in 8th grade. And by my freshman year of high school, I was failing classes. So things progressed really rapidly for me. My dad was an alcoholic, but he got sober before I was born, so I knew a lot about alcoholism. I knew I had the predisposition. I knew that if I was to drink, I might become an alcoholic. So I said from a very early age, I just was never going to drink. Well, the first opportunity I got to drink, I drank, and I got drunk. And I didn't do it every day, but every opportunity I got, and I created a lot, I did. And I got into high school, and I started using drugs, and things just went downhill. I was expelled from school my sophomore year of high school. I got an OWI my junior year and was at a point of desperation. Did not want to continue to live. Couldn't stand being told what to do, but my way was obviously not working. And I got sent to YSS. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be told what to do. I think I told the program staff what they could do with their treatment plan. I was one step from getting kicked out of that program within the first week. But something happened there. All my life, I had manipulated situations. I had pushed people to the brink. You might know a kid like this, maybe, where they just keep pushing, and you can't get through to them. And I eventually had a knack at getting my way, because I would wear you down to the point that you would just simply say, "Fine, kid, go ruin your life." And for the first time in my life, they would not give in. And so just like you break a wild horse is the best analogy that I can have. Just like you break a wild horse, they continued to ensure that I didn't get my way. Essentially, they stood firm. And there's a lot of sayings. One of them is sick and tired of being sick and tired. And 6 weeks into treatment, my mom had taken me to get a test at Iowa State. And the first time I'd left treatment, the first time I'd been on my own, I stole a half-smoked Virginia Slim luxury light 120 menthol cigarette out of her ashtray. I smoked it. I got back to treatment. No one knew that I had smoked it, but I had this sense in the pit of my stomach, like maybe I shouldn't have done that. And over the course of about 30 minutes, it moved up into my chest, and I was having a hard time breathing, and it moved up into my neck, and I could hardly swallow. And I found myself on my knees. A 712 Burnett, just two blocks away from where we're sitting right now, crying like a baby at 17 and three quarters years of age, saying, "I can't keep living like this anymore." And I surrendered for the very first time. And I decided that I would just do what they told me to do. And lo and behold, my life started to change. And so there's a lot of things that happened between then and now, but that was the turning point. That was the transition from everything focused on me to maybe I should look external to me and think about, you know, how I can better serve my community, about how I can assimilate as opposed to, push forward with my own priorities.
So that really strikes a chord with me, because my first job at the employment office was to administrate the Job Corps program.
Yeah.
So I went out and contacted dropouts in the Des Moines area, visited them in their homes, presented them with an opportunity. Now, it was a residential program, and they went out to Job Corps centers, kind of like the old CCC camps, vocational training, and to complete their high school. And the theory was to take them out of the environment and the neighborhood and the peer group they grew up with. And I saw young people change their lives. They did. It was my African-American clients were the first union tradesmen who were of a minority in Des Moines history.
Wow.
So I just saw this great transition. And when you talk about your experience, that dovetails with some of my clients. And then there were those who failed and ran away and came back to Des Moines. And at some point, each of the ones I saw that changed their lives had some kind of mountaintop experience,
yeah,
like you're describing, where it couldn't go on anymore and they made some kind of choice. That's really what happened to you, isn't it, Andrew?
Yeah. I feel like it was spiritual. I feel like it was God-inspired. It was definitely a mountaintop experience. It was the point at which everything changed. Now, could you see it right away? Maybe not. Did it take some time to set in? Obviously, but it was the foundation for a new life.
So, having seen YSS from the inside as a client, and now running the program, how do you describe the organization? Everybody's heard about YSS, but how do you tell people about what it is you do? You have a variety of programs. How do you describe what it is you do to people?
Yeah, when I started 4 years ago, it was hard for me to wrap my head around everything that we do.
So many things.
And I started to describe programs to people, and I'd get to like the 10th or 11th out of 40, and I would see their eyes glaze over. My predecessor, George Bulitsos, just did such an amazing job creating the foundation for this organization. He had a knack for identifying issues in the community and then creating programs and funding streams to address the needs. There's just not much that YSS doesn't do. But here's how I describe the agency today. As you know, for 40 years, we were known as Youth and Shelter Services.
Right.
Today, we're just simply known as YSS. And we did launch with a branding campaign called Youth Standing Strong. Well, we started in shelter, and that is at our core. Today, we work in prevention, treatment, transition services, and child welfare. And so you can't work in these emergency-type situations like shelter, where you've got kids in distress that have experienced trauma, without asking yourself, is there something we could have done to prevent this from happening in the first place? And so we spend about a quarter of our budget on prevention-related programs, mentoring, before and after school programs, family development programs. We go into classrooms and teach the 21st century version of DARE called talking about too good for drugs. And so we're doing a lot on the front end to try to give kids and families good information and make good decisions. The treatment section of our programs are really inpatient substance abuse treatment and outpatient therapy and counseling, medication management. The inpatient treatment program is where I got sober. It's 90 to 120 days. Kids from across the state come to Ames and Mason City now. And they get treatment from skilled professionals who understand addiction. They get the tools that they need to have that sort of transformational experience. It's a program I'm obviously really proud of. I am an alumnus. Our outpatient therapy and counseling, we've got more than 1,000 kids and families, you might not know that, coming through our doors every week. Talk therapy, talking to counseling, licensed clinicians who are helping kids deal with anxiety and depression and work through adversity and trauma in their life. We do medication management as well there and some coordination of services through an integrated health home. We do child welfare services. So those are kids that have been placed in the Department of Human Services, the DHS system, so experienced trauma or are in a living situation that's not safe. And so we've got two shelters, the very first runaway and youth shelter in Iowa right here in Ames. And then we merged with an organization 3 years ago in Mason City called Francis Lauer, and we've got a shelter there. We do foster and adoptive care. So you think about kids that are in the system. They need stable places to land and families to love on them. And we organize something called AMP, Achieving Maximum Potential, a program that really helps kids in the foster care system advocate on behalf of themselves. They've helped pass more than 40 laws over the past 10 years. It's pretty cool. And the final services, the final program area is transition services, so helping youth transition into adulthood. We run the Iowa Aftercare Services Network, a statewide network of 7 different providers that are working with more than 500 kids who've aged out of the foster care system. And these are kids that are at high risk for incarceration, at high risk for homelessness, at high risk for human sex trafficking, because they just don't have a family to fall back on. And so we provide case management to them for 3 years, and we went to the legislature last year, a big win for this state. We worked hard, advocated, lobbied, and we got the program increased to age 23. So now 5 full years after they age out of the foster care.
See, that's a problem.
That's
people
right.
Age out. And I think that overnight thing they do at stadiums for the cardboard boxes.
Yeah, Reggie Sleepout, that's us.
Yeah. Well, you see, That's what happened to that young man. He aged out of all the services, and he still needed help. And so look at how your program addresses that. One thing that is educating me today, and Dennis does such good research on YSS, man, 21 locations in six communities, and I just thought of YSS as Ames, and I'm stupid.
headquartered in Ames. It's where Ames and Story County, where the majority of our programs are, but we've got 40 employees, and I've got 21,000 square feet right downtown Des Moines,
the
Youth Opportunity
building.
Center, and I was just there last night. 350 total employees across the agency, and we open up 5,000 to 7,000 individual case files on kids every year. So you think that's the size of my hometown, Nevada, where I grew up. The impact of this agency is great, and we've got so many committed professionals, experts in their field across the agency that are helping this to happen.
And they're led by you, who has been there. You know, you're constantly able to keep your staff in touch with the fact that even though they're professionals and trained, it's nice to have someone who has a background in living that life that these kids are living. It's just a real resource to have that. You've turned something that has been a real drawback to you in your life into a unique perspective on your clientele and what you're trying to do. Now, where does funding come from for YSS?
Yeah, we're about a $20 million organization. I generally say about 70% of that are grants and contracts that come through the state or the federal government. So YSS has been successful at drawing down on state and federal funds. We've got a good infrastructure in place. We've got a proven track record. And when there is a need and there's funding available, we do a pretty good job at drawing that down. 25% is fee for service that's coming through insurance companies and Medicaid for the treatment that we provide, the therapy and counseling that we provide. But the rest, the last 5%, is so important. It is the cream on top. It is the frosting on the cake. It is what allows us to just take that one extra step that you might not be able to do with base funding to provide the services that we provide to the kids. And that's through fundraising and through community support. So we just have such a great group of committed people who have given time, talent, and treasure to this agency over the years. I'm so proud of the fundraising campaigns that we put together, the capital campaigns that this community has been so generous with. Organizations like United Way, we've got in Ames asset, which is the county and the university and the mental health, not the mental health region anymore, but United Way and the City of Ames coming together to provide funding for nonprofit organizations. So we work really, really hard to pull together that local funding that, like I said, is it's the cream on top.
Well,
it
you
really
and George have made a great effort, and you've been successful at establishing those relationships and, more importantly, preserving them, continuing them, because a one-time contribution is different than something that's done annually because they feel involved in your program.
That's right. It's stewardship.
Describe the shelter homes that you have here in Ames. A couple of them are in Old Town near where I live, and I walk by them all the time. They have different clientele in each of those homes.
That's right.
Can you talk about those, if
you would? Three residential programs here in Ames. One is the shelter where we started, and those are kids 12 to 18 who have experienced trauma. They come through the Department of Human Services. We don't pick them. They don't. A family could do a family referral if they need some respite or if they've got something going on at home and they need some help. Generally, we try to de-escalate a situation, get them the help they need, get the kid home. Most of these kids come through the Department of Human Services, and they are they're awaiting placement in another facility. They're awaiting a period of time when they can go back home or find a foster family. It should be short term, 30 days. But generally speaking, kids that have experienced significant trauma, you read about them in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. When something bad happens, a child dies and they remove other kids from a home. That's the call that we get at 10:30 on a Tuesday night. Hey, we're coming by with a brother-sister pair, mm-hmm. And we take care of them. The other residential programs here in Ames are the substance abuse treatment programs, and we're the only adolescent gender-based program in the state. So we separate the boys from the girls, and I'm telling you, this is a good idea.
Yes.
It's a good idea not just for obvious reasons, but there's research behind it that says girls do better when they are by themselves. They're not thinking about what boys are doing, and the boys aren't thinking about, you know, what the girls are thinking. So we separate those two programs, and that is a 90 to 120-day program. It's paid for generally by insurance. We're working towards transformation with these kids. In each case, they go to school. They've got in-home schools. They participate in community activities. We try to get them engaged in volunteer activities. They go to Food at First and serve meals down there on a regular basis. They go to 12-step meetings in the community. They go to the pool. They experience a lot of what AIMS is while they're here. And you got to remember, these are 16, 17-year-old drug addict, alcoholic kids. These are other kids in the shelter are kids that have been in really abusive situations. So we're so appreciative of Old Town and the way that we've been able to assimilate within the community. George's philosophy was community-based and to put these programs in old houses so it feels like home. I'll tell you today that the home-like setting is important to us as an agency. Having said that, old houses aren't as durable as you might need in a clinical setting or in a setting where you've got kids that have experienced a lot of trauma and abuse. And so we're thinking about, you know, long-term, what are our plans as it relates to facilities? You know, we had a fire 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. Gosh, how long ago was it? I think it was a year and a half ago in July. And decided to take that insurance money, and we're putting it into a fund, and we are testing a capital campaign to build a new shelter and residential facility. So we're not ready to announce anything or launch yet, but we're getting close, and it'll be important to me and the agency and the kids that we serve and the staff that are so committed that it be a home-like setting, durable but home-like.
And you'd keep the other two shelters that are currently in place?
Yeah, that's right. What we would do is probably turn those into transitional living programs or halfway houses. So after the residential program, some kids it makes sense to stay here. Here's a big vision is if you can keep someone sober for a year, there's just a 50% chance of relapse. Treatment's tough. Sometimes people go through treatment half a dozen times. If you can keep someone sober for 4 years, just a 15% chance of relapse. Well, nobody's got a four-year program, do they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, two or three miles to our west is a four-year program. It's called Iowa State University. So what if we could bring kids from across the state? We graduate 80% of them successfully, 4 out of 5. Give them the 90 days of treatment that they need. Get them connected with a recovery high school where they could finish their high school diploma. And then have a direct line into DMACC or Iowa State, right, where they would get the support of what we're calling a collegiate recovering community. And now you take a 90-day program that, while we get good results out of the gate, you know, upon 6 and 12-month follow-ups, a lot of these kids are still struggling. Could we keep them engaged for 4.5 years with diminishing intensity where it costs less in year 3 than it did in year 1? And essentially graduate people 4.5 years sober with just a 15% chance of relapse and an engineering degree or a business degree or an education degree and set their foundation for forever. So that's my big vision. I think that we will get there. Just this Saturday, if I can put a plug in, Louisiana Monroe is going to be at Jack Trice Stadium playing our beloved Iowa State Cyclones, and it'll be our second annual sober tailgate. All right. When you think tailgate, you don't generally think sober, right?
Yeah, right.
I've been sober for 23 years, active in recovery, 12-step program. I sure don't think about drinking, but when I'm in that tailgate environment, I see everybody having fun. There is a lot of drinking going on.
Right.
Last year we did this offsite, which kind of made sense, but also didn't feel like a real great tailgate. It was before a game. It was at a park. It was, you know, 2 miles away from the stadium. This year, Iowa State University is having it. It's Saturday, 8 until 11, so 3 hours before kickoff at Ryman Gardens. President Wendy Winterstein will be there. Her husband, Robert Wagoner, who is on my board, will be there. Martino Harmon will be there as well. And it's a place to come to celebrate recovery and sobriety. College, university setting, it's not just Iowa State, it's everywhere, it's really a difficult place to be sober. I almost want to call it hostile towards sobriety. Yet, one in six of us will have a substance use disorder over a lifetime. If there, I don't think there are quite 36,000 students anymore, but when there were, that's 6,000 students who could benefit from recovery. So I am so excited that Iowa State's embracing a collegiate recovery community. It's going to create a platform and a place for some of the kids that we serve.
Andrew, we're out of time, unfortunately. We, and I know I speak for Paul. Paul can speak for himself. This is great information. Oh, yeah. We want to have you back.
What committed me so much when I was doing Job Corps was the idea that if you're going to intervene in someone's life and give them an opportunity, do it when they're young and formative.
That's right.
You know. Thank you very much today.
Well, thanks, guys, for what you're doing.
You bet. Andrew Ellen, head of YSS, great organization in the community. Don't touch that dial, because coming up after this brief timeout, we're going to look at the week's news from the Ames Tribune.
Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. It is 27 minutes after the hour. Time for a weekly rundown of news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. And there was plenty to report, starting with last Saturday when the Trib had word that volunteers had spread out around Story County on Friday, part of the United Way's annual Day of Caring. That event brings nonprofits, residents, and businesses together to better the community. Kicks off the United Way's annual fundraiser. This year's goal, $2 million. Saturday's paper also reported that a new tenant is moving into the Iowa State University Research Park. Stellar Industries makes hydraulic truck-mounted equipment. The company is based in Iowa and is owned and operated by its own employees. Sunday's Trib reported that staff members of the Coldwater Golf Links are worried about plans to extend Grand Avenue in Ames. That project would extend Grand through the Golf Links in order to get the avenue to South 16th Street. Golf course spokesman says he doesn't oppose the project, but says the city has not given him any word about when it might start or how much it might disrupt the course. Sunday also brought word that the Miracle League Field and Inclusive Playground project in Ames had gotten a big boost last week when it received a $200,000 grant from the Iowa Economic Development Authority. That $2 million project involves building an all-inclusive playground with ramps and rubber surfaces and a rubber-surfaced youth baseball field accessible by wheelchair at Inez Grove Park. And yes, Sunday's paper had word about a certain football game you might have heard something about. Yeah, that one involved Iowa State and the University of Iowa at Jack Trice Stadium. And yes, the Hawkeyes defeated the Cyclones 18-17 in a game that took a mere 6 hours to play because of two long thunderstorm-related delays. 6 hours. Tuesday's paper reported that Ames police had written more than 700 parking tickets on Saturday during that football game day. The PD also arrested 16 people for being drunk in public, and one for drunk driving, and cited 51 others for possessing alcohol under the legal age. Tuesday's Trib also reported that the second of three defendants accused of breaking into a home in Kelly last year and assaulting an 82-year-old woman had agreed to plead guilty. 18-year-old Jacob E. Jimenez will serve up to 60 years in prison. One more note from Tuesday, a story about an Ames High student who's been honored for her passion and advocacy for civil liberties. Her name, Malika Davis. She's been recognized by the American Civil Liberties Union for advocating for LGBTQ issues. Wednesday brought word that Iowa State University was proposing a new entertainment complex that could be built on the 41-acre parking lot between Jack Trice Stadium and the Hilton Coliseum. Consultants will start work on a $300,000 feasibility study for the project. Athletic director Jamie Pollard said he envisions a possible hotel and convention center along with restaurants and other entertainment options, such as an ice skating rink and maybe a new practice center for the university's wrestling and volleyball teams. He said it's too early to predict how much all of this might cost. Also worried about something that may or may not have happened off the field when Iowa State played Iowa last Saturday, Iowa's athletic director sent out a press release that referenced inappropriate actions during the Hawkeye marching band or against the Hawkeye marching band while it was attending the game. ISU athletic director Jamie Pollard said he didn't know anything about it and that Iowa's press release was, in his words, pretty vague. But later in the week, the athletic director said that bands from both schools had been bullied by football fans over the years, no matter where the game was played, and they asked fans to behave better in a more civilized manner. Thursday, yesterday, the Trib reported that a new Iowa State University poll showed Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren leading among probable Iowa caucus-goers. She was favored by 24%, followed by former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders with 6%, 16%. And there was a story about the Altoona man. You probably read this and seen this on TV. He was in the audience a week ago when ESPN's Game Day pregame football show aired live from Jack Trice Stadium. Seems that 24-year-old Carson King had held up a sign that appeared on the air, a sign asking for money so he could buy beer. He said he was hoping to get a few bucks. Turns out he raised a bit more than that. As of yesterday, he had raised $225,000, counting matching donations. Carson King said he would donate that money to Children's Hospital in Iowa City. Good for you, Carson. Today's paper, Friday's, has word that the Brunier Art Museum officially reopened its doors in the Sheman Building at Iowa State Center in Ames yesterday. It had been closed for 20 months for renovation. Also a report that the 4-H Foundation is putting the Clover Woods Camp and Retreat Center near Madrid up for sale, the reason fewer and fewer campers had been using it. You can also read about this area's annual junk jaunt in today's paper. That takes place this weekend. It's a road trip that takes shoppers to such places as Jewel, Story City, Gilbert, Slater, Ames, and places in between. One more note, Ames apparently going to join the rest of the world today, at least a part of Ames, in protesting climate change from 2 to 5 o'clock at Ames City Hall. Lots of young people and others expected to show up in what's being called a strike for climate change. Paul, that's quite a story about the guy who wanted money for beer, and he's raised $225,000 for the kids' hospital in Iowa City. That is a great story.
It's a heartwarming story, and it just shows that people out there respond to the... It shows you the power of social media, first of all. Secondly, he could have kept that money, I suppose, and I think it went to like $30,000. So a lot of these things are matching gifts
funds
from people.
That's right.
It just shows you how goodwill is contagious.
Carson King and everybody else who's donated, that's great work. Thanks very much for doing that for the children of Children's Hospital in Iowa City. That's your summary of the week's news from the Ames Trib. Coming up next, Alex Pfeiffer of the Ames History Museum joins us in this guest seat. And after that, Maggie Westfold's going to bring us one of her unique looks at life right here in Iowa.
To more of Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio. Now joining us is Alex Pfeiffer of the Ames History Museum, which is going gangbusters with its latest exhibit, Uncorked, the Spirited History of Alcohol in Ames. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me again for our usual third Friday of the month.
And we seem to talk about beer a lot, at least the last couple of Fridays. Talk about this exhibit. I've seen it. Have you had a chance to see it yet,
Paul? No, I've
got to
do that before it expires.
It's a great exhibit.
Yeah.
Describe this thing at the Ames History Center.
Oh, sure.
Douglas.
So when we were planning our next exhibit, we were trying to think of what would be a good topic coming up. And in the back of our minds for a few years has been the 100th anniversary of Prohibition's been coming up. And Ames has a lot of great alcohol stories, not just during the 20s. And so we knew that this was a good catalyst for us to talk about some of those awesome stories. Because there's one where I think a lot of people in town know it. It's been around for a while. It's one that Farrell Brown's told about. Our lovely Sherwood Hotel that's was located where the Octagon Art Center is today.
Right.
And that was the site of kind of a Kerry Nation style busting up of breaking down a saloon when Ames got its first saloon in 1868. 13 women in town wouldn't have it and went down, busted down the door, and basically ran this guy out of town. So there's a great story like that that we already knew in our community, but realize that there's a couple more out there that we're able to track down. So this is a great thing. You know, it's everything from the founding of Ames as a dry town. Like, you could literally not sell alcohol on your premises, or your land deed would revert back to the railroad land company. All the way up to Visha riots and local microbreweries and wineries in town. So it's a good little mix of everything from, you know, turn of the century and before to stuff that's current and things in the community that we actually, there are a lot of people that are around and remember that kind of stuff.
No, it's fascinating because, number one, no one probably knew that this town was particularly dry when compared to other towns. I know in a previous interview we talked about the lack of a liquor store.
Yep, lack of a liquor store. That was always a big deal.
Nevada or Boone.
Yep, exactly. Nevada and Boone having the largest ones in town. Yeah, that was until we got, you know, those state liquor stores, like some of you very well remember, got started in the 30s. But Ames did not get one until 1963, 30 years later. So there's a whole generation of kids that were born, turned 21, and still couldn't buy a drink in town.
So there was no place then until those liquor stores came in, the state-run stores.
Yep.
And there were two or three, right?
Yep. There's usually two. There's a couple locations, but at most two at any time.
Nobody sold it privately. No bars sold it or anything like that?
No, you couldn't do that. They're technically, at that time, they're, for what our consideration today of what a bar is, there technically weren't bars back then. To get a drink, all you could get was fresh beer, cold beer on tap someplace, but that was it. And the places that had beer on tap were restaurants with lunch counters, places like that. So to actually get a drink of liquor somewhere, there's a couple things you could do. You could get what they called setups. You'd go to your local cafe and order you get, I think it was like two glasses for a dollar or something like that of ice. You could get a Coke or 7-Up, whatever you wanted to mix in. And you just brought your own bottle. You pulled it out of your jacket pocket and your brown bag, and you made your own little mixed drink there. And that was the norm, to walk around with that on you when you were doing that kind of a thing. Years later, once liquor by the drink kind of happened, then you kind of got the social clubs like the Elks and the Moose Lodge, and those where you could have a bottle there also, and that was in about like the mid-60s or so that was going on. So it was a lot different than going in and ordering a shot and a beer and having a good time in Campus Town watching a football game. A lot different environment to wrap your mind around.
And I think a lot of this was the founder, he was a teetotaler. That's where you had the rule that your land reverted
John
to
Blair.
The railroad.
Yes,
and
John
then,
Blair.
The other part was protecting the Iowa State University students from the life of alcohol and horrible outcomes, right?
They didn't trust the students to make good decisions, it seems, throughout the years. They wanted to make sure that they made the good decisions for the students.
Well,
I think
probably at the tailgates, there are a lot of bad decisions being made.
Oh yeah, daily. But every minute, I'm sure there's a bad decision made at a tailgate down there.
Now, you have this is a great exhibit.
Thank you.
I mean this sincerely, and no one makes money on this thing. You go in there and it's free. You can go
see
this. Oh
yeah, free. Come on off the street anytime we're open.
But you have a speakeasy.
We have made a
hidden speakeasy.
Yes.
And talk about the rumors about the speakeasy in Ames. Please talk
about
that.
Sure, yeah, because that was something we kept as we were talking about doing this exhibit, you know, just people coming in off the street, chatting, you know, people asking me, what are you guys up to? What's going to be coming out in the future? Mentioning the alcohol exhibit. A lot of people talk about a possible speakeasy in the Sheldon Munn. So we tried to do a lot of research to see if we could verify that. Any, you know, newspaper articles talking about it getting busted up, even just a mention of it. But unfortunately, we're unable to find anything. You hear a lot about Boone and Nevada speakeasies getting busted up, shut down, reopening up, but nothing about Ames ones. And so, but there are a lot of rumors about the Sheldon Munn being a possible location for one. As the hotel has been shut down since the 70s and as it's been reused and people have been remodeling that through the years, they've noticed that there is in the basement, there is, which has an alley, there's a door in the alley that leads down to the basement to a nice little kind of tiled area down there. And so it seems like a nice little speakeasy location like that. We don't actually have any proof of anyone that ever went down there or ran anything, but there's this little spot down there that looks like it's just screaming to be a speakeasy. Now, when the hotel opened up in the teens, they had what they called a smoker in the basement. So when they had the dance floor on the fourth floor, the men could come downstairs, smoke their cigars, you know, drink a little bit down there too, kind of get away from the women. So it's possible that that kind of maybe evolved in from a smoker to a speakeasy, which would seem natural. But I think without a doubt, we can probably say that that fourth room ballroom was the place to be. It was hopping, and I'm sure liquor and alcohol were making their way up there somehow, whether it be through a little speakeasy in the basement or just coming through the back doors and straight up there. I'm sure there was something happening at Sheldon Munn.
So the floor in the basement of the Sheldon Munn is not just cement. Is it looks like a finished floor, or
yes,
mosaics or something?
It's tiled down there, yeah.
So it looks like people were social down there.
Yeah, obviously something was going on. I don't know if you'd hire a bunch of contractors to come in and build you a speakeasy necessarily and do all that work, but it could have been from an earlier era possibly. And
well, we always
reused.
Think of the little door within the door, and you open that little door. Joe sent me.
Yep, exactly.
That's like in all the old movie. Joe sent me.
I don't know that Mr. Sheldon or Mr. Munn would really have appreciated that, either one of them.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, thinking about that. I don't know if we know too much about if either one of those guys like to partake in a drink or two. I'm sure they had a little wine, maybe a little sherry.
So it was illegal to sell alcohol, but it wasn't illegal to possess alcohol.
Yeah, so you could not transport, sell, or create to make it.
So what do we know about private house parties? Are there rumblings about certain houses of certain people really being wild places on a Friday or Saturday
night? Nothing that we were aware of, or nothing that got really written up in the paper and stuff like that. The hard part is, especially Ames being really what we talked about, such a conservative town about alcohol up until the 60s. And like we talked about state liquor stores, a lot of people, even when Ames got a state liquor store, still didn't want to be seen in that state liquor store. So they would still go off to the Nevada one or the Boone. So unfortunately, you know, that generation that was having a little bit of fun in the 1920s, they've been gone for a little while. And so there aren't a lot of those people around. And our founder, Farwell Brown, he was not of that vein. He was a teetotaler himself. So I don't think he was too interested when he was doing his research about interviewing people that liked to have a little more fun back then either. So we've kind of lost a little air of those party people in Ames history.
Well, that's just interesting because when I look at your job and how you do research, number one, I'm sure that your main source are newspapers.
That's
that
a big
go way
one.
Back. Do you have a complete set of newspapers that go way back that's pretty inclusive, or are there gaps?
There are some gaps, but they are pretty good. So we have paper versions at our place, which are not as good as the microfilm. The microfilm is the most complete collection that exists, and those go back to 1877. The first newspaper was in 1868, I believe. So there's about a 10-year beginning gap that's missing, which is right where our nice women getting run out of running the saloon out of town story happened. So unfortunately, we can't even get a firsthand account of that story, which has a couple various ways that people have told it through the years, 50-some years later. So the newspaper, it was a big one for getting a lot of these stories, especially the bootlegger stories. You mentioned the speakeasy we made. So we wanted to make a speakeasy because we thought that'd be fun, and we didn't know if Ames ever officially had one, so we said, let's make one in here. And we were able to actually incorporate stories of bootleggers, Ames bootleggers, into the bar top of the bar there. So you can go in.
Yeah.
It's a little two- or three-seat bar. You can have a seat there and read about some of these guys coming through town. And some are just funny little stories, you know, not much big trouble. But other ones where there's a guy from Chicago that came to town, got busted, and he had on him a list of some of Ames's young and most prominent men about town that he was supposed to deliver to.
Ooh.
And it said, and also some not so young prominent men were on the list too.
Wow.
What an incriminating list.
I know.
Circumstantial evidence, right?
I wish we could get that list. That would probably tell us where some of those house parties were at back in the day.
Oh, but so we don't know who's on that list.
We do not know.
Oh, they're all dead. You can't blackmail
them.
That speakeasy is a marvelous place. I mean, I've been there a couple of times and I wanted to spend the whole afternoon. It's a hidden little place
yes.
in that exhibit. I just just warn you, look for it, and it's beautiful. Talk about a little bit of the history of the state liquor stores, both across the state and here in Ames, because a lot of us don't really have that good background on the history of that.
Yeah, sure. So state liquor store, so right after Prohibition, each state got to decide how they were going to handle liquor. And Iowa and a few other states decided that they were going to do state-run liquor stores. And so they were going to control the sale and also provide permits of that. So you couldn't – it's not like you just walking into Hy-Vee Drug and you can basically just load up as many shopping carts with beer and liquor as you want and no one's really going to question you. Back then, you could only purchase a certain amount also. So you had a little booklet – kind of about the size of a credit card-ish. And you had to go to that store, and they had a big old board on the back wall basically listing off all of the types. So it was just like a number coding system. So they could write it in your book and the amount you had and pay for it. And those lasted up until so Ames, they started right after Prohibition, about, I think, 1934, 1935. They got the system underway for starting that. And almost immediately – Ames City Council, a representative of ISU student body government, said, we do not want this liquor store. They were pretty adamant that this is going to be bad for the town. It's going to be bad for the college students. They're going to, you know, turn Visha into a riotous occasion or something like that.
They had foresight on that, didn't they?
So they really tried to put the stop on that forever, and they were successful for 30 years of keeping the state liquor stores away. I mean, the city council is actually putting out statements saying, we don't want a state liquor store, and the state liquor store saying, that's fine, we weren't trying to put one here. Like, they're being very proactive about saying, making sure that they know that they are not wanted in the town, but... It's not until the 80s that starts to really go away. So some people might remember buying stuff at the Ward Plaza on South Duff, kind of where Walmart is today. Or there was one in West Ames near kind of west of the Hy-Vee over there on Dotson Drive. And then the last one from that era was where Cyclone Liquors is today. And that actually transitioned from a state-run liquor store to a privately-run liquor store in 1986 is when they did all the liquidation and got rid of all the stocks. You could get great discounts, I think from 40 to 60% off your favorite liquors and wines. And then eventually they closed that down in 87, and that's when the liquor stores opened, and you get places like Hy-Vee's and stuff selling liquor.
We're almost out of time. How long does this exhibit?
This exhibit will be up until summer 2020. We don't have a for sure end date up right now, but you'll be able to see it through the winter and up until next summer for sure. So
it'll warm your heart to go see it, Paul.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've got to do it.
The speakeasy.
I'm glad you told me the end date because I've got to get in. You know, you're a very creative person. You can either have a museum that's passive and sort of stagnant, or you can have people who are creative about creating themes and exhibits, and you're one of those.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun putting that one together with the speakeasy and just getting all the barrels and making beer boxes. It's quite the sight.
I got to get there, I promise.
You get there, Paul.
We'll see you.
Alex Fafer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you can see that down at 416 Douglas, Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4.
It's a great exhibit. Go see it. Now, don't go away. Maggie Westfold's right here. She's going to have something to say about life in Iowa, and you're not going to want to miss it.
To know. Yes, I've got bad news, baby, and you're the first to know.
Well, we're back with Local Talk Friday, and we're happy that our friend and colleague Maggie Westfold is back from her vacation.
Yay!
And she's here with another one of her takes about life in Iowa.
Hey, Maggie.
Hello, Dennis and Paul. And it's good to be back after a couple weeks away. Today, I just thought I'd talk a little about, on the airwaves of community radio, about another type of entertainment, television. I find myself comparing notes with family and friends now and again about what they like to watch. I often ask out of just simple curiosity because I personally struggle to find much on the with the regular TV programming that appeals to me, and I always have hope that I'm going to hear about something I've been missing. It seems like reality television and competitions have taken over to a great degree. Someone suggested to me that this type of programming is less costly as it requires less in the way of script writing, hiring of actors and actresses, directing, and so forth, and they might be right. What I know is that for me, they offer little in the way of entertainment that holds my attention. I was lucky to grow up in an era when families sat down together in the evening and watched family programs like Father Knows Best, and variety programs like Ed Sullivan, comedy like Red Skelton, and good old westerns like Gunsmoke with Matt and Kitty and Chester and Doc and maybe The Rifleman also. Tennessee Ernie Ford was one of my mom's favorite singing performers, and he often sang spirituals, and he had a genuine rapport with his audience that made him fairly popular. Mom liked to guess that he was likely a relative somewhere back in the family tree because her maiden name was Ford. I was from a big family, so we learned to take turns also as far as what we watched. And when my dad was in his chair after working hard all day, he often won out, but I don't recall watching many programs I didn't enjoy. It was a family affair with only one television set in the house. There's an element of togetherness in that setting that's missing these days. Many homes have screens in practically every room, and family members rarely sit together and watch. The need to negotiate no longer exists, and that's not necessarily a good thing. When I met my husband, it was interesting to learn that his family had also watched Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. My husband's family was of a different faith than Bishop Sheen, but my husband said his dad admired what Bishop Sheen had to say each week. My memories of Bishop Sheen are not so much what he had to say, but rather the way he strolled onto the stage in his robe and walked back and forth as he talked, and that large wooden cross dangling from his rope belt. The man had a stage presence that held the attention of even some children, and those piercing dark eyes punctuated what he had to say. When our two children were growing up, there seemed to be decent programming available, but my daughter's 7 years older than her little brother will tell you, however, that I would not allow her to watch The Dukes of Hazzard because it was, in my estimation, crazy stuff. However, when I noticed that her rambunctious little brother at about 3 years of age actually sat still for 5 minutes straight and watched that orange car go flying through the air, well, let's say Mom broadened her scope and we added The Dukes to the approved list. My husband and I are movie fans, and we also like to watch episodes on Netflix. We enjoy public television programming from time to time also, but regular programming offers little that entertains us, and we pay too much to that cable company for all those channels we do not watch. Now, what kind of good sense does that make, friends? I need to remind myself that we always have another option. Turn off the TV and turn on the radio and enjoy some wonderful programming on KHOI Community Radio.
Boy, Paul, doesn't that take you back to the old days of watching television with your family? It was a family event. Black and white TV. My parents and I always watched Ed Sullivan, Red Skelton, Perry Mason, Candid Camera, What's My Line? You got together and everybody watched those shows.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. I live on the farm I grew up on after a career in Des Moines. I'm actually receiving my TV signal on the same aerial that brought in Leave It to Beaver in the 60s.
Wow.
It's a throwback every time I turn on the TV. There was a great experience of commonality.
Absolutely.
We all saw the same thing.
Maggie, yeah. Will you come back and give us some more about life here in Iowa?
I'll try and do that.
We always enjoy having you here. And we love that here on KHOI.
It's a great paper.
You have been listening to Local Talk Friday. We're happy about that. I'm Dennis Hart.
And I'm Paul Wearson. Local Talk also airs today at noon and 5. 5 p.m. here on KHOI. We're at 89.1 FM. And you can hear a recording of this show later today online, too, at KHOIFM.org, as well as finding links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live right online at KHOIFM.org.
Our theme song, as always, Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come on down and join the Local Talk team.
Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 and Morning Masterpieces at 9. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio. Have a great weekend.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Cirque May, Wednesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.